From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Country music singer Don Walter is getting his big break at the age of 60. He retired from his government job this year and made his first commercially released recording. He's been performing since the 50s, when he sometimes shared the bill with Buddy Holly in small Texas towns. On today's Fresh Air, the heartfelt ballads and yodeling of Don Walter. Also today, taking care of people with AIDS. We talk with Rebecca Brown about her new book, which is based on her experiences as a home care worker. And critic Maureen Corrigan reviews a new edition of the 1939 novel Kind Relations by the late British writer Robert Liddell. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. Authorities in Iowa say at least four people died this morning in an explosion at a fertilizer plant near Sioux City. Tim Post from member station KWIT describes the scene.
There was an explosion in the ammonia nitrate building, and that's about a 6- to 7-story building, and it leveled that building, left a crater, and damaged all of the buildings at the plant. Office buildings, the windows are blown out. Other buildings, the roofs are blown off. Actually, the blast ruptured a few tanks that contained ammonia. So there was an ammonia cloud headed south from Sioux City right along the ground. Cold weather kept the ammonia cloud close to the ground. They are evacuating quite a few towns south of Sioux City, but about 1,700 people are being evacuated at this point.
Reporter Tim Post near Sioux City, Iowa. NATO defense ministers meeting in Brussels said they were frustrated with the UN command in Bosnia for its reluctance to order airstrikes to protect UN peacekeepers. On Monday, 5 UN soldiers from Bangladesh were wounded in a missile attack and one died today. NATO chief Willy Klaas said the alliance was always ready for airstrikes, but the UN has not asked. Defense Secretary William Perry says some NATO members are looking at ways to strengthen the UN mission. Those might include creating a protected corridor to ship supplies to Sarajevo. The Justice Department says former Kentucky Congressman Carl Perkins has agreed to plead guilty to 3 felony counts in connection with a 2-year investigation of the former House bank. The department says the charges include lying to the Federal Election Commission and writing bad checks at the House bank, which was closed down after inappropriate transactions by some members of Congress were made public. The Food and Drug Administration today announced new rules to help doctors get information they need to safely prescribe medications for children. NPR's Vicky Quay reports.
Most of the prescription drugs used in the U.S. haven't been tested specifically on children. Pharmaceutical companies have refused to do these studies because they're difficult and expensive. But pediatricians say they often have to guess at dosages and worry about side effects. In the past, the Food and Drug Administration has required full clinical trials on children before drugs could be labeled for pediatric use. But under the new rules, companies with certain drugs will be able to skip these studies. The changes apply only when the treatment and course of disease is similar in both adults and children, and drug makers would have to prove this is the case. Critics question whether companies are being asked to provide enough evidence. I'm Vicky Quay in Washington.
Hundreds more U.S. forces arrived in Panama today to increase security at Cuban refugee camps. Riots in the camps last week injured more than 200 American soldiers, and tensions remain high. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is unchanged at 3718.37 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. The federal government has asked users of the Internet to help with the search for a serial mail bomber. The FBI has posted an offer of $1 million for the suspect's capture or conviction. Officials say going on the Internet gets the information out to the type of people that have been victims of the package bomb attacks, scholars and researchers. The FBI believes the same man is responsible for a series of mail bomb incidents dating back 16 years. The Amtrak Board of Directors has been meeting today to consider cutbacks in service. The railroad system faces a $2 million budget deficit for this fiscal year. From member station WNYC, Dick Hinchliffe reports from New York.
To close the deficit, Amtrak officials are reportedly looking at the elimination of little-used routes and running fewer trains on busy lines, including the Northeast Corridor between New York and Washington. Amtrak runs more than 200 trains a day nationwide on a budget subsidized by the federal government. With the changing winds in Washington, the size of future federal subsidies is uncertain. Amtrak says last year's revenues were hurt by harsh winter weather, which caused disruptions, and smokers finding other means of travel when a smoking ban went into effect. Some rail advocates say Amtrak is exaggerating its fiscal problems, but many would agree the railroad is struggling to remain competitive with discount airline fares. The Amtrak board's decision on cutbacks could be announced as early as tomorrow. For National Public Radio, I'm Dick Hinchliffe in New York.
The United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR, will soon cut food aid to Afghan refugees living in camps in Pakistan. UNHCR says many refugees have become, in its words, economically self-reliant and don't need the handouts for survival. The agency also says it has limited resources and more urgent refugee situations elsewhere. UNHCR says food aid will not be cut to disabled people and women heading families by themselves, but due to the UN announcement, Pakistan plans to speed up repatriation of Afghan refugees. I'm Laura Kanoy, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Country music styles have come and gone. Don Walter says he's still singing the same way he did back in the 1950s, when he sometimes shared the bill with the young Buddy Holly in small Texas towns. Walter has a gift for singing ballads and for yodeling, but he never made it commercially, so he kept his day job. He worked in the National Guard as a mechanic and administrator, then worked for the state of Texas. He retired earlier this year when he turned 60. His retirement coincided with his first commercially released recording, Rolling Stone from Texas, on the Austin-based label Watermelon. Walter's lived in Austin since the late 80s, where he's developed a following among alternative rock fans as well as fans of classic country music. Before we meet Don Walter, let's hear his recording of the yodeling cowboy ballad Cowpoke.
I'm lonesome, but I'm happy. Rich, but I'm broke. And the good Lord knows the reason. I'm just a cowboy. From Dallas to Austin, the ranges I know. I drift with the wind. No one cares where I go.
Don Walser, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be talking with you today.
What happens to your voice when you yodel? How do you do it?
Well, it's kind of done down in your throat, and you hit a falsetto, and then you just come right back out of it to something else, you know. You know, like, you know, it sounds kind of dumb when you're doing it like that, but then if you speed it up, it's, you see what I'm saying?
Uh-huh. Well, you do an Eddie Arnold song on your new album, I'll Hold You in My Heart Till I Can Hold You in My Arms. And one of the things I love about your version of this song is that you don't yodel in the song, but you use that kind of falsetto yodel-like quality in the melody. You just, like, work it into the melody line.
Right. That was Ray Benson's idea. Him and T.J. McFarlane produced this CD, and he said, why don't you try a falsetto on the end of it and just do the melody? He'd heard me do it before on other songs, and so I have to blame that on him. That wasn't the way I usually sung it, but I'm glad that he came up with the idea, because I really enjoy it.
Well, this is I'll Hold You in My Heart from Don Walser's new album, Rolling Stone from Texas. Really a beautiful recording. Don Walser, I'd like to get back to your yodeling for a moment. D-
Do you feel like you know different styles of yodeling, or is there just one style that's the Don Walser style?
Well, I think that I do a Jimmy Rogers type yodel. I think we put one. Yeah, we did. We put California Blues on there, and it's a different kind of yodel. But I sort of do a Swiss yodel, and I kind of patterned that after hearing the Jimmy Wakeley song that Slim Whitman did back in the late 40s, I believe it was. I believe it was in the late 40s that he did Casting My Lasso. And I liked that Swiss yodel, and I started doing that more. And, of course, Elton Britt did some things like Cannonball Yodel and stuff like that got me to doing that.
What's the difference between a Swiss yodel and a cowboy yodel? And maybe you could demonstrate the difference for us.
Well, a cowboy yodel is sort of like, sort of like that, you know. And then a Swiss yodel is more like, you know, it's more of a double yodel than the cowboy yodel is. You know, like an old cowboy song. I remember I used to do one when I was growing up called Rainbow in the Rio Colorado, and it has a kind of different yodel to it too. And I don't know, it's just I just sort of developed a lot of the yodels because I didn't have access out there where I grew up to anyone else's yodels, and I still haven't really paid much attention. I've been, you know, so busy throughout my life that I really hadn't bought and listened to other folks yodeling. I guess I need to do that, but I haven't.
Did you learn to do this before your voice changed or after?
You know, I don't think my voice changed a whole lot.
Really?
It may have gotten maybe even higher whenever when it changed, because I believe that I can sing higher than I could when I was about 15 years old.
Huh.
And that's strange. I don't understand it, but that's kind of the way it's been. I know I used to sing some folk songs with a couple of girls, and they would always make me sing lower than I wanted to.
Take us back to your childhood a little bit. Would you describe for us where you grew up?
I grew up in a little farming community of La Mesa, Texas, right between Lubbock and Big Spring, out on the South Plains of Texas, a little strip of land right below the Panhandle. And my mother passed away when I was about not quite 12 years old. And in those days, the Lubbock County and up in there had a lot of cotton. And the old La Mesa Cotton Oil Mill was where my father worked, and he was the night superintendent. And back in those days, when the mill run, well, you had to be there all the time. So he worked from 6 in the afternoon, in the evening, until 6 in the morning, 7 days a week while the mill was running. And that usually was at least 6 to 8 months during the year, and sometimes even longer, according to the size of the crop.
So your mother died when you were 12. Your father mm-hmm. worked, 12 hours a day at the mill. Who took care of you?
Nobody. I just stayed at home. I would kind of, you know, when you're young like that, you see things that's not there, you know. So I kept the radio going all the time, you know. Even at night, I'd go to sleep with it. And if I woke up during the night, well, I'd listen to it a while. And it's always on one of those old border stations from down in Mexico or the Grand Ole Opry, and I just grew up on that old music, and I almost had a photographic memory, and I remembered most of those songs, and I still do remember most of them, and I never wanted to sing anything but those songs because they sort of helped me make it, you know, through life.
Is there a song that you found particularly comforting when you were home alone at night and a little afraid and you'd put on the radio?
Well, I liked the old heart songs and the ballads more than I did the boogie woogies and things like that. But I think, you know, back in those days, the B movies and the old radio programs that they had, they depicted life, I think, just a little bit better than what it is. And I think today the music we hear, a lot of it, and a lot of the movies that we see depict life a lot worse than what it really is, you know. And I think that's where I got most of my raising was from listening to those songs. I remember Eddie Arnold had a song out one time. It called Rocking Alone in an Old Rocking Chair. And it was about a neglected grandmother. And after listening to that, I said, boy, I'll never let mine do that.
Can you sing a couple of lines of that?
Yeah, let me get my guitar here. Rocking alone in an old rocking chair, I spied an old mother with silvery hair. She seemed so neglected as I saw her there. Rocking alone in an old rocking chair, her hands were calloused, withered and old. A life of hard work was the story they told. And I thought of angels as I saw her there, rocking alone in an old rocking chair. It wouldn't take much to gladden her heart, just some small remembrance on somebody's part. A card or a letter would brighten life there, rocking alone in an old rocking chair. I know some kids in an orphan's home who'd think they owned heaven if she were their own. They'd never be glad to let her sit there, rocking alone in an old rocking chair.
Oh, that sounds great. Thank you so much for singing that for us. I think I can really understand why you alone without a mother would so relate to this song about a woman alone who is neglected.
Well, that's kind of the why I love these old songs, because and why I try to keep them alive.
So when did you get a guitar? I mean, your family was poor.
That's another story. There's a cousin of mine, J.R. Wright was his name. He married one of my cousins, and I used to get up in a tree, you know, when I'd come home from school. Even before mother died, I would get up in that tree and sing, because I just had to sing, you know, every day. And I had to find a place where I could do it, because I was kind of ashamed to do it in front of anybody. And I'd get up in the tree and sing. And sometimes I'd stay up there till after dark, and then I'd get down and come in the house after dark. But I remember that years later I would meet some of the folks from home, and they'd say, oh, you're the little guy that used to get up in the tree and sing. And I didn't realize they was even listening to me. And my kin folks would always make me sing, and because they enjoyed what I sung. But they all said, you need to learn how to play guitar. And J.R. Wright bought me an old Stella guitar way back when I was about 13 or 14 years old. And, of course, I didn't have a book to learn from. And I learned how to grip it like a club instead of pushing your hand out and playing it right, you know. But I'd learned, I went to a Tex Ritter movie and learned the C chord. I got to watching where his fingers were. And some guy down the street knew three or four chords. And I just sort of learned it from other people and watching them. And I really learned it the wrong way. If I'd have been able to, you know, afford a teacher or something, I've probably been. I'm still not a very good guitar player. I can just sort of get by.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Don Walser. He has a new CD called Rolling Stone from Texas. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
back with singer and guitarist Don Walser. Now, I know that where you grew up was not far from Lubbock.
That's
of course,
right.
Lubbock's big star was Buddy Holly. And I know now, that there were times you shared a bill with him, right?
Oh, yes. Of course, back then I didn't really know who he was, but there was a drive-in theater there in La Mesa, Texas that Skeet Nart had this old drive-in called a Skyview. And, in fact, it's still operating. It's one of the last ones that hadn't been closed down. And he had a ramp house where you could go sit in the wintertime and watch it instead of running your heater in your car, and you had seats that you could watch through the glass in the ramp house. Then he had a big projection room there and he had a little stage on top of it, and he would bring in guys like Hoyle Nix and Buddy Holly, and I would always play with them. You know, each time I would play some, and they'd have a new recording guy, you know, somebody that would come out with a new hit song and that lived in that part of the country, and they would have them come down and play at the Skyview during between the movies, you know, and I would share bills with them. And then also one of his Buddy Holly's first, I don't know if he's a manager or just worked with him, his name was High Pockets Duncan. And I don't know his real name, but he was a disc jockey on KDAV there in Lubbock, and I didn't have a telephone, and he'd get in touch with me. He'd say, some of you folks over there in La Mesa, they called me Donnie back then, said, tell old Donnie Walser that I want him to be at such and such place at such and such a time, and that's the way I'd get word. Someone would hear it, and they'd come tell me, High Pockets want you to be so in a certain place, you know, and that's kind of the way I found out, in a way. I did share bills with lots of people. And back then, he was just a tall, Buddy Holly was just a tall boy with glasses, and I didn't really realize who he was until many years later.
Did rock and roll make it hard for you to do your music?
Yeah, it put a bunch of us almost out of business there for a while when Elvis and some of those guys came in. And it was good music, and I even did a little of it myself, but it never was, my heart never was there, you know, so just kept doing plugging away at what I do now, you know.
Which Elvis songs did you do?
Oh, Heartbreak Hotel and some of those, three or four of them, just enough to satisfy some of the young girls that was in the crowd.
do a couple of bars of Heartbreak Hotel the way you do
boy.
It.
I don't even know if I can do it anymore. It's been so many years. Let's see. I don't even I gotta find the right key here. Well, since my baby left me, I found a new place to dwell. Down at the end of Lonely Street, Heartbreak Hotel, I get so lonely, baby. I get so lonely. I get so lonely, I could die. That's not very good, but
that's great. So there was a period when you felt like Elvis and other rock and rollers were starting to put you out of business. What did you do?
Well, we just kept playing. We would do a few of those songs. And I love Chuck Berry. We used to do a lot of Chuck Berry songs. And not a lot of them, but a few enough to get us through the night, you know.
Uh-huh.
But, I think that old rock and roll music was great music. And I still love to hear it. We got a group here in Austin called the High Noon Boys that do that stuff. They even made a 78 RPM record not too long ago using the old tube stuff that they used to record with back in those days.
Are you a grandfather now?
Oh, yes. I have 5 grandchildren.
So what's it like for you now to be singing all these songs to probably bigger audiences and broader audiences than ever, and to be a grandfather at the same time?
Oh, it's great. I get to bring my grandkids out sometimes that we play a couple of places we play down that regularly, because we want to be in some place regularly, and we play like in Babe's on 6th Street every Monday, and then little Mexican restaurant called Jovita's down on South 1st Street here in Austin, and I always can bring my grandkids there and they can listen to the music and enjoy themselves. And it's good.
Did you ever want to be the young singer who was really good looking and all the girls fell for, and you know, to become a big like romantic hero as well as a singer?
I think all of us did that. Going, I had the star syndrome there for a couple of years until I realized that I was having more fun than the stars were. You know, I was getting to play for weddings and old VFW halls and getting right there with the people, and I didn't have to worry about Carnegie Hall or any of those places. But I did have to take my wife. I told her when we married, I said, I'm in the National Guard, and I'll stay there till I retire, and I'm going to be gone some each year to go to summer camp. And I said, I'm going to play my music all my life, and so you got to get used to that. And if you don't trust me, then you've got to go with me. And I sort of insisted when we were young that she'd go with me, and so she could see that I was straight. You know what I mean? But I wasn't a bad-looking old boy when I was younger and had a few pounds off of me. And I did have a few of them try to chase me, but they always was afraid of my wife. You know how that goes.
So she did travel with you through the years?
Oh, yeah. She went everywhere I went back in those days. Now she doesn't go to every place. She comes out to a couple of places and helps me sell what products we have and so forth. But she trusts me now after all these years. And she says I'm like an old dog chasing a car anyway. If a dog caught the car, he couldn't drive it anyway.
Don Walzer, it's just been a pleasure to have you here. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, too. And we appreciate the privilege we have of being able to do this sort of thing. And I hope that the people will go back out and not just buy our stuff, but get the folks that do the old traditional stuff and listen to those great old songs.
Don Walzer, his new album is called Rolling Stone from Texas. It's on Watermelon Records. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's another song from Walzer's new CD.
I got my angel on my mind, that's why I'm walking. I've got an ache in this old heart, and I'm not talking. Little hands that held me tight, just to wave goodbye tonight. I got her sweet love on my mind, that's why I'm walking. Oh, with an old love on your mind, life ain't worth living. I breathe her name with every breath I'm breathing. Why couldn't I ever see just what she meant to me? I got her sweet love on my mind, that's why I'm
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The AIDS epidemic has created a new network of home care workers. For several years, Rebecca Brown assisted people with AIDS, bathing them, applying ointment to lesions, cooking, cleaning, whatever would be helpful. That work is the basis of her new book, The Gifts of the Body. Coming up, we'll talk about her work taking care of people with AIDS. And critic Maureen Carrigan reviews Kind Relations, a new edition of a 1939 novel about a young British boy at the time of World War I. It's by the late British writer Robert Liddell. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. An explosion at a chemical plant near Sioux City, Iowa, has killed at least 4 people and injured more than 30. Officials are evacuating those who live and work nearby, but some people are still unaccounted for. Mark Moran of member station WOI reports.
Workers at the Terra Industries plant just outside Sioux City produce farm chemicals. Officials still don't know what caused the blast that some felt as far as 60 miles away. The plant's above-ground storage tanks contain ammonium nitrate and nitric acid, toxic chemicals used to manufacture farm fertilizers. Christina Martin, Governor Terry Branstad's spokeswoman, says the National Guard has been called in to help.
The Guard right now in Sioux City is providing generators for use in the evacuation of chemicals, as well as providing some personnel.
Environmental officials are warning people to avoid contact with a hovering ammonia vapor cloud. Emergency workers are trying to determine what other chemicals may have been released in the blast. The facility is the biggest chemical plant in the state. For National Public Radio, this is Mark Moran reporting.
Incoming House Minority Leader Richard Gephardt says House Democrats will propose an income tax cut next year for families earning less than $75,000 a year. In a speech this morning, Gephardt outlined his vision for the Democrats after the party was trounced in November's elections. The Missouri congressman said businesses should be given incentives to share profits with workers. And he said Democrats won't try to stall a vote on a balanced budget amendment. But Gephardt added the Republicans have to be honest about how they'll pay for that plan. The Justice Department says former Kentucky Congressman Carl Perkins has agreed to plead guilty to 3 felony charges, including writing bad checks at the House Bank. The case is part of a 2-year department investigation of improper transactions at the House Bank. The bank was closed after the scandal became public. Perkins represented Kentucky's 7th congressional district from 1984 to 1993. Panamanian authorities are continuing to search for missing Cuban refugees following riots at refugee camps last week. Tomas Cabal reports from Panama City.
At least 10 Cuban citizens that escaped last week from U.S.-controlled refugee camps in Panama have evaded an intensive manhunt carried out by Panamanian authorities. Panamanian officials confirm that immigration inspectors at the Costa Rican border have detained one of the Cuban rafters that tried to cross into Costa Rican territory. A spokesman for the Costa Rican Embassy in Panama City said that his government will cooperate with their Panamanian counterparts, but if the Cubans reach Costa Rican territory, they may be granted political asylum. U.S. military officials responsible for camp security believe all of the escapees will be caught before being able to cross into Costa Rica. For National Public Radio, this is Tomas Cabal in Panama City.
On Wall Street, stocks closed mixed today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 3 points to close at 3715.34. This is NPR. The Republican Party may hold its 1996 convention in San Diego. A GOP committee today said negotiations with the city could begin soon. Republican National Committee Chair Haley Barbour strongly supports San Diego. The only major concern is the city's relatively small convention hall. Former presidential candidate Paul Tsongas says the country may need a third political party. In a Boston Globe interview, Tsongas said it could be a passionate center party if led by the right person. The former Massachusetts Democratic senator said he would not use the third party to run for president. Tsongas proposed former Joint Chiefs Chairman Colin Powell as a possible leader, adding that he hasn't talked to Powell about that. The most extensive war crimes trial since World War II has opened in Ethiopia. The country hopes to punish the former regime of dictator Mengistu Haile Mariam on charges of genocide and crimes against humanity. NPR's Michael Scholar reports.
For 17 years, Mengistu ruled with a cruelty difficult to imagine. It wasn't simply that his government killed 100,000 or more suspected opponents, many teenage students, but his Revolutionary Guard arrested mothers who mourned for their children and demanded parents pay for the bullets used to kill. Mengistu blocked foreign food aid during a catastrophic famine a decade ago and even bombed a crowded market town, all to punish opponents. Perhaps most incredible, his officials documented their cruelty, filing away execution orders, even videotaping torture sessions. When Mengistu fled in defeat 3 years ago, the new government captured many of his officers. And today, prosecutors began trying the first group of top officials. The trials could last for several years. This is Michael Scholar in Addis Ababa.
Russian police say several ancient manuscripts have been stolen from a national library in St. Petersburg. Some documents date as far back as the 6th century and could be worth as much as $100 million. I'm Laura Kanoy, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. People have responded to the AIDS epidemic in many different ways. Writer Rebecca Brown decided to provide home care, first on a volunteer basis, then professionally. For 2 years, she took a break from writing to visit the homes of people with AIDS and do whatever she could to be of help. Her new novel, The Gifts of the Body, is based on those experiences. She told me about the things she did to help people with AIDS.
Do their laundry, clean their bathroom, wash their toilets, clean out the refrigerator, pour them a glass of juice, lift their head up when they need you to hold their head so they can drink something out of a straw, change their TV channel for them if they don't have a remote, and there's a lot of listening. I think when these folks that I was dealing with were getting near the end of their lives, they had a lot of things they were thinking about, and sometimes it's easier to say those things to a stranger than someone in your family. Or there's a kind of intimacy you get if you know someone well enough to, like, you know, help them change their clothes, that in the act of that they'll say, well, you know, I've been thinking about something. And so it's very, very close. In many ways, easy work, but in many ways, I don't know, just really, really deep and rewarding. At least it was for me.
What you're saying reminds me of a passage that I want you to read. This is a passage about somebody who is planning on going into hospice, but after the home care worker arrives, he decides, no, that he wants to stay home.
Yeah.
Putting the home care worker in a tough spot. Let me ask you to read that passage for us.
Yeah. It's a passage from a chapter called The Gift of Tears, and the guy we're talking about is a fellow named Ed, who the home care worker's been working with for a while, and Ed's a great guy, but he's a little testy, and he's scared, you know, of dying and of the prospect of what's going to happen to him. And he has this really blustery kind of, I don't care, I'm a tough guy, I can handle it kind of thing. So anyway, the home care worker, the eye narrator, is watching TV with Ed, and she's just brought him his breakfast, which is oatmeal and stuff, and they've been waiting for this call from the hospice to say, okay, Ed, we've got a room. So Ed gets the call and asks the home care worker to leave the room so he can talk to the hospice people himself. And when she comes back to the room, this is where the scene begins. I'm not going, Ed said. I told him I might come later. He stared straight at me. You can't force me to go. No one's trying to force you, Ed. We just thought. I don't care what you just thought, Ed said. I don't care what any of you, my case manager or my doctors or any of those 55,000 idiot nurses or idiot orderlies or any of you idiot do-gooders think. I'm not going. In training, they said if they ever got verbally or physically abusive, you should leave. But this wasn't that. Ed's face looked tight. His hands were gripping the remote control of the TV so tight he was shaking. His knuckles were white. I'm sorry, Ed, I said. It took him a few seconds. Then he said, you don't know what it's like. I know I don't, Ed. I'm sorry. Ed's mouth moved. He picked his spoon up off the napkin. The oatmeal hadn't been touched. He held the spoon in his fist like a baby who can't hold it in his fingers yet. His mouth was shut tight. His eyelids were red. He put the spoon towards the oatmeal. A skin had formed on the surface. He stuck the spoon through the skin. He made a noise like he was starting to cry. Oh, Ed, I said. He put his hands against the bowl like he wanted to push it away. I moved to push it away. No, leave it, he sobbed. I can eat it. I want to eat it. Do you want me to heat it up, I said, or make you a new bowl? His lips were pressed very tight. The edges of them looked white. I don't know, he sniffed. I don't know. I don't know. He dropped his spoon and put his face in his hands. His shoulder shook. I touched his shoulder. He dropped his hands from his face and looked at me. His face and eyes were red. His mouth was moving. The rest of him was trying to cry, but something was wrong with his tear ducts, and he couldn't.
Rebecca, is that passage based on something that happened to you?
This fellow, this Ed character, is pretty closely based on the personality of a man I worked really closely with. And he had an opportunity to go to a hospice that really he was in two minds about, because it was so hard for him to stay at home. But, you know, once they say you got the room at the hospice, it's like in order to get a room at the hospice, you have to, like, have a note from your doctor saying you have less than 6 months to live, right? So once you say, I'm going to the hospice, it's like I'm dead in 6 months. And he didn't really want to say that. So it was really hard for him, and he wanted so much to fight it, and he did, but you can only fight it so long, really. So in real life, he did go to the hospice, and in real life, he's passed away, and, you know, bless his heart. So yeah, it was based on someone I knew.
There's a passage from your novel, The Gifts of the Body, that I'd like you to read about a home care worker visiting a patient with lesions.
Yeah. This chapter is from, it's called The Gift of Sight, and she's, the home care worker's being a substitute helper for this guy who's not a regular client of hers. This guy was the scariest to look at. This guy really looked like the plague. Margaret had said the only special thing I'd need to do was put a salve on him. The salve was thick, opaque, yellowish jelly. It came in a big, wide-mouthed plastic jar. It didn't smell like anything. The first time I went there and opened the jar, I saw the tracks of someone else's fingers where they'd gone in to get the salve. I don't know why it frightened me so much, but it did. I was afraid to touch him. I was afraid to look at him. His sores were dark purple and about the size of quarters. The edges of them were yellow, and his skin was dark brown. The sores weren't running or oozy or scabs because they always had this salve on them. I was allowed to put on the salve, even though I wasn't allowed to give meds, because this salve wasn't really a med so much as something just to comfort. It couldn't heal anything. I don't know if the sores were itchy or hot or how exactly they felt bad to him, but I didn't ask. I hadn't been scared to ask about anything before, of nurses or docs or my supervisor or the guys themselves. The guys especially liked to explain things. They liked that I asked and that they could tell me what they knew. They'd all become experts. The first time I put the salve on, I didn't know if the temperature of it would be uncomfortable, like when massage oil, if it isn't skin temperature, feels so cold that you can't feel the good. I wanted to ask him, but I couldn't. I couldn't say anything out loud about the sores.
Is this what it was like for you, Rebecca, the first time you had a client who had sores that you needed to apply ointment on?
Yeah, this one is certainly autobiographical about my experience with it. KS is a really frightening thing to look at, and your heart just breaks when you see these people that have it. But yeah, I was scared. It was really scary looking to me. Even though I knew I couldn't get it, and I was following safe procedures with my gloves and everything, it's an ugly, frightening looking symptom of the disease.
My guest is Rebecca Brown. Her new novel, The Gifts of the Body, is based on her 2 years as a home care worker helping people with AIDS. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer and former home care worker Rebecca Brown. Did you never know when somebody was going to be embarrassed by something and when they would not be? It, particularly in terms of like loss of body control and sores and lesions, things that are difficult to see.
Yeah, well, sometimes somebody's embarrassment would be obvious. You know, when somebody would say, look, I'm incontinent, I'm really embarrassed, can you change my diaper? And other times they'd say, can you change my diaper? And they wouldn't say I'm embarrassed, but I would just kind of assume they were, because I would be. But then there's another point at which, you know, some of these people are living with this disease for so long that they're beyond embarrassment. You know, they're just like, they're basically just trying to live and be able to talk to their friends or to be able to die with some kind of comfort. I mean, on the one hand, embarrassment is a real luxurious feeling. You can feel embarrassment if you're not completely racked with pain. So sometimes I felt I knew because they would tell me, and other times I'd say, geez, I don't know what these people are feeling. I don't have this disease. And I just kind of have to take cues from them.
In all the work that you had to do, what was most difficult for you to do?
I guess I always felt like whenever these people died, that was the saddest thing. I never got to the point that it was, like, okay for them to go. And in some ways, I always felt like I and the world was abandoning them. You know, we hadn't found the cure quick enough, or I hadn't comforted them enough, which is completely crazy. I mean, you do what you can do, but I never got to the point that it was, for me, okay that these people died. They died, and it still always saddened me. And that's really why I had to stop doing the work, when those feelings kind of started getting in the way of the practical help I was able to be to these people.
Did you have to learn a way to lift people up and carry them to the bath?
Yeah. Before I started doing volunteer work with this local organization, there was a weekend training session in which we're taught about universal precautions and the kinds of foods these folks like to eat and you know, things to look out for. And as I moved from being a volunteer to doing this as a quote professional, I underwent another training in which we learn how to, you know, move people in and out of wheelchairs and help people move in and out of baths and use a bath seat. And so there is a lot of just basic physical training that was very necessary for me to learn, that you don't just pick someone up, that you're very careful about how you hold them and where the strong and weak points are.
When you were doing home care work, did you find that there are certain things you could do for a person with AIDS that their family or friends or a lover might be uncomfortable doing?
Absolutely. And again, it depends on the person you're dealing with. Some people, you know, some of the folks with AIDS don't want a stranger dealing with them in these really intimate, give them a bath kind of ways. And there were other people that, well, for example, there's a character in the book who's a mom and a grandmom, and she just, it's so hard for her to allow her kids or her grandkids to give her a bath or to do the things that she did to them when they were babies. And that somehow if a stranger does it, it's easier rather than to have someone who knew your body when it was full and beautiful and capable take care of it when it's ailing and falling apart.
Did most of the people who you cared for have friends or family who could help them?
Some of them did, and then some of them, and this was a really sad thing, there were some people that, as far as I could tell, you know, didn't really have friends or family, and the caregivers really became their family, the people they saw every day. And one fellow actually said to me, I mean, here's a guy dying of AIDS. He was at the end of his life, and he just said, oh, all of you caregivers have just been my best friends, and it's such a blessing to have met all these nice people when I've been sick. And I was like, you'd break your heart to hear that. but he, you know, he was learning a lot about love at the end of his life and teaching a lot about love, too.
Did you find in a way that it was easier to be physically intimate with the strangers who you had a professional relationship with than with friends who you're close with?
Yes. Yeah. When they became sick, I was already really emotionally involved with them. And everything in my body was saying, don't die, don't die. Whereas with the professional relationship with the clients, I knew they were going to die, and I was like trying to help them do that in the way that they wanted to. And with my friends, it was like, look, you can't do this.
Is there a shyness, too, when it's somebody who you already know well as opposed to, again, the professional relationship?
Yeah. And a lot of times those folks want to use strangers from these agencies that I've worked with, and it makes perfect sense to me, you know, that they don't want their friends dealing with their messes. You know, they want us to, you know, do the medical errands or, you know, come bring over a bottle of sparkling cider and watch TV with them, but they want someone else to do the diapers and the bedpans, and I understand that.
Well, it must be nice to have eyes you can look into without feeling that you're seeing the parts of yourself that you're most embarrassed about reflected back at you.
I suppose. It's like being really basically human. It's like being a baby again, but being sentient, you know, that our bodies are precious and they're incredibly messy. And being embarrassed about the body we inhabit.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Rebecca Brown's new novel is called The Gifts of the Body. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah, they're talking about cutting taxes in Washington.
You bet. President Clinton is talking about a middle-class tax cut. There is a Democratic plan in Congress to cut taxes for families with income less than $75,000. Republicans in Congress are looking at a plan to cut taxes for those families with incomes up to $200,000. Also, there's been an explosion at a fertilizer plant near Sioux City, Iowa. Several people have been killed, many injured. There's been an evacuation because of toxic ammonia gas in the area. Michael Scholar reports from Ethiopia on the opening of a genocide trial involving the former leadership of Ethiopia. Alan Chews talks about books that would be good to get and receive for Christmas.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. British novelist Robert Liddell, who died in 1992, has been called the most unknown major British writer of the century. But that situation is changing. The latest Liddell novel to make it over to this side of the Atlantic is Kind Relations, a 1939 novel that was the first in a trilogy Liddell wrote about his own family. Maureen Corrigan has a review.
Lots of women who've written slim, slice-of-life novels have been compared to Jane Austen. There's Barbara Pym, Muriel Spark, even the glum Anita Bruckner. But Robert Liddell is the only male novelist I can think of who critics almost universally liken to Austen. And having just read Liddell's ironic elegy on his own childhood, entitled Kind Relations, I can see why. Liddell's world is the width of a couple of English country houses. Though his novel spans the years 1914 to 1918, the First World War takes place offstage, just as the Napoleonic Wars made only a muted impact on Austen's fiction. Both Liddell and Austen prefer to zoom in on the battle of wills that rages within families and between friends and lovers. Austen's droll narrators like to float above these clashes and give color commentary. That's where Liddell breaks away from his mentor. In Kind Relations, the story is filtered through the consciousness of a little boy who's the pawn in a family feud. Nothing too nasty happens here, no physical abuse or neglect. But Liddell does such an exquisite job of recapturing childhood anxieties. He makes you squirm in your seat and feel again the misery of a child's utter dependence on adults. Kind Relations gave me a gut-level understanding of why all the little kids I know revere the Macaulay Culkin of the Home Alone movies, as though he were a pint-sized Spartacus. Kind Relations opens on the destruction of 6-year-old Andrew Farrington's world. War breaks out, his father, an army colonel, is dispatched to Egypt, and his mother dies. Andrew learns of her death from his nurse, nicknamed Nandy. Here's how he reacts. Andrew buried his head in Nandy's lap and cried into her apron. Andrew wondered when his mother would come back. He thought of asking Nandi, but something prevented him. He was afraid of being told for certain that she would not return. He wanted so much to be able to believe that she would. Deep inside, that dim yearning always remains with Andrew, even as he comes to understand his mother has been called away for more than just a heavenly rest cure. Andrew, his baby brother Stephen, and Nandi settle in for the duration of the war with two of Andrew's aunts. But then another aunt maneuvers the boys away to her house, where they're tormented by their older cousins. Meanwhile, back in Egypt, Colonel Farrington has remarried. And much to Andrew's patriotic horror, his new stepmother is a Hun. Occasionally, Liddell gives us glimpses of how the war accelerated life in even Andrew's sleepy English village. No more Gilbert and Sullivan evening band concerts. Everybody's busy rolling bandages instead. But mostly, kind relations sticks to the slow time of the nursery and the schoolroom. As a novelist, Liddell is like some kind of sweet, sympathetic uncle who plays on the floor with his child characters and enters completely into their imaginations. This sounds cloying, but it's not, because Liddell also never forgets the constant, low-level childhood dread of hearing the footsteps of an approaching adult.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Kind Relations by Robert Liddell. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Nancy Updike. Research assistance from Becky Cohn. Sienna Christman is our intern. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Tracy Ullman. She co-stars in Robert Altman's new film about the fashion industry. And we talk with Graham Payne about his new memoir, My Life with Noel Coward. Payne lived with Coward for close to 30 years. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.